My name is Alan Mallinson. I was a soldier for 35 years. I retired, I suppose, 10 years ago to write full-time. And I'm here in Lancaster to give a speech, a talk, questions and answers. And the talk is going to be about the opening of the First World War.
And it's quite ironic that today is the 100th anniversary of the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand, so I don't think there's a better place to start. Was it the start of World War One? A lot of historians argue they slithered over the abyss, or even the Fisher thesis is thrown around. So in your view, historically, what did cause the outbreak of war?
Well, it was the spark to the great pile of tinder, if you like, that had been accumulated over the years. The various military alliances, the strange paranoia that the Kaiser and his military establishment had in Germany about the need for expansion, the need to prepare for an inevitable war with Russia as they saw it, the need to challenge British sea power, something that was not necessary for them. But of course, sea power to us as an island nation was everything. That was our security. We didn't have a large army. We had a large navy to secure these islands against attack and also to protect our overseas trade and our imports on which our livelihood developed. But it was the assassination of the Archduke at Sarajevo that set in train the slow, initially, movement to war that gained pace during the latter part of July and ended up with decisions being taken which triggered in turn other decisions, and the accelerating pace was really beyond anyone to do anything to halt. And we tumbled into war.
A lot of questions are raised about who actually started the war, who was to blame for the war. That was obviously profound in the Treaty of Versailles. Who was to blame for the war? Is it all the Germans, or do we all have to take our part?
Let me quote the French Prime Minister in 1919, who, when asked by a colleague at a memorial service, "I wonder what history will make about the beginning of the First World War," replied, "Whatever history will say about the beginning of the First World War, it will not say that Belgium invaded Germany." And in that fact is a nugget of truth, that if you take out the German acts of aggression, you would not have had a First World War. And I think that is incontestable. There were other actions that, had they not taken place, might have meant that it didn't come to a clash of arms. But it was the willingness of Germany to declare war on Russia, which inevitably therefore meant war with France, because, as they well knew, Russia and France were in a military alliance, and if you declared war on one, meant war with the other. They knew that, and then decided to invade France through neutral Belgium, which was actually the final spur to Britain's declaring war. We were obliged in both law and honour to go to the defence of Belgium, a country whose neutrality we had guaranteed by treaty. And it is an interesting question, of course, whether, if the Germans had decided to invade France the direct way rather than through Belgium, would we have gone to war in August 1914, or would we have gone to war in the way that we did? That's an unanswerable question.
This war was not just for out on the Western Front, out in the sea, out in the air. This was very much a home front battle as well. So how did, you know, the war, in a nutshell — I know it's very hard, we could go on for hours discussing this — but what was different about this war to any other previously?
In a nutshell, the numbers involved. It was assumed before the war began that if there were another war in Europe, it would be over quickly, as other wars in Europe had been over. The Franco-Prussian War in 1870 was over in a matter of weeks. The Austro-Prussian War a few years before, again, was over in a matter of weeks. Large armies manoeuvring, gaining advantage, a decisive battle, and then surrender. But what happened in the First World War was that both sides, French and the Russians on the one side, the Germans and the Austrians on the other, were able to put into the field huge armies, armies of well over a million men as a result of their system of conscription, which gave them a huge pool of reserves to call back up. So you're talking about armies which were capable of absorbing much more punishment. The idea of a decisive battle when there are a million men in the field, it's rather fanciful. We, of course, didn't have a large army. We had, by comparison, a very small one. We were only able to put into the field about 100,000 men initially. And so when the two sides fought each other to a standstill towards the end of October, and both sides started digging trenches, which eventually extended from the North Sea coast right the way to the Swiss border. You've got a giant siege, in other words, on the Western Front. What both sides then sought to do was to make their armies even larger to try to break through. And the British experience was that we needed then to raise an army of the size of the French and the Germans, a million men, which could only be done by the famous call to arms celebrated by that Kitchener poster, "Your country, Kitchener poster, your country needs you," and the raising of local battalions by all sorts of means of encouragement and inducement is really the story of the First World War. How localism, local pride, the response to what was seen as the German effrontery, the notion that a country should not be allowed to behave like this, to invade a neutral country such as Belgium. A very strong feeling of, you know, Germany was a bully, and we don't approve of bullies. The response from all over Britain of men who had everyday jobs to put on uniform, to train, to go out and fight, is a story. We had never done it before. We had never had so many men under arms. We never did it again, even in the Second World War. We never raised quite as many men for the task. But it was very much a local response. The King's Own, the local regiment here in Lancaster, based at Bower and Barracks, as then was, raised 20-odd and more battalions. Battalions numbering 1,000 or so men each.
And there's so much literature being written, especially with the centenary. So what does your book focus on, and what angles have you found that have been particularly interesting? Any new facts?
It's terribly easy to think about the First World War as the trenches and nothing else. The war was a world war. It was taking place in the Middle East. It was taking place in Africa. It was taking place on the high seas, and increasingly it was taking place in the air. But the principal image that people have in their mind, is it not, is of the trenches. But there was a time before the trenches, 2 months of fighting above ground, a war of movement, of great possibilities, which in the end petered out, as I say, when the pick and the shovel were taken up and the trenches were dug. And this period, the fighting was done principally by the old regular army before the territorials arrived on the scene and before Kitchener's men did. And it seemed to me that this period of fighting, which in many ways was the decisive period because it thwarted the German plan to knock out France early, it seemed to me that this period had been underwritten. And I wanted to talk about the first month or so's fighting and remind people that there was a period before the trenches. And also, there was a period after the trenches in the latter part of 1918 where the war of mobility was restored, and in 3 months of fighting, the British Army, and it really was the British Army at that stage because the French were so exhausted they could hardly take part in the counteroffensive, the British Army in a war of manoeuvre outfought the Germans and really pressed them to the appeal for an armistice. Does my book say anything new? Well, I didn't expect it to, because after 100 years, who would expect to find anything new to say? But the curious thing is, when you go to the National Archives in London and you start digging in the papers at the time, you see things sometimes differently. And there was one particular memorandum written in 1911, which suggested how a war between France and Germany would develop in Europe, and therefore what measures a British army, if we sent one, should take. And that memorandum was dismissed by the professionals, the general staff in the War Office and everyone else, as being unrealistic, fanciful. It couldn't happen in that way. And that memorandum was written by Winston Churchill at the age of 35, who at that stage was the Home Secretary. And really, you know, it wasn't his business, as the professionals saw it, to trespass on their area. And this memorandum has been known about and referred to in various books, but not in totality. It talks about Winston Churchill's memorandum proving prescient in, he said what the Germans would do, and they did. But the important part of the memorandum, which no one has ever written about before, is the second half of what I was suggesting, i.e. what the British should do as a result, how the British Expeditionary Force should be deployed, and indeed how the French should operate. And what I decided to do was to analyse his alternative suggestion in the light of events, and see if things might have been different, to see if it was actually a better vision than the general staff's. And my conclusion was, had we done what Churchill suggested in that memorandum, we would have had not nearly so many casualties. And the result of the fighting in October might have been very different, and certainly the I'm not saying necessarily that the war would have been over any earlier. I believe it could have been. But the circumstances of our fighting would have been very different. We would have been occupying very much better ground with a shorter front and with far more resources. And this, of course, is everything when it comes to fighting. So that is quite a revelation, and it's been acknowledged as a revelation.